Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. In this episode of The Generation Y, I interview Rabia, who has been the powerful voice for Adnan since his incarceration. She recently put out a book called The Search for Truth and Justice After Serial, Adnan's Story. And if you are not up to speed on the case, or if you didn't listen to Serial or Undisclosed or Truth and Justice, you might be a little lost and you might not be up on current events, but we delved into a lot of details about the case and issues with Adnan's defense. So if you don't know anything about his story and you've been living under a rock, you might be a little lost during this episode, but otherwise anyone else should be able to go right along for the ride. Rabia is very quick on her feet and a very fast talker, so try to keep up.
Hello.
Hey, Rabia. How you doing?
Hi, Justin. How are you?
Pretty good. Not that you need any introduction, but say who you are, what your background is.
So, hi. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I am an attorney. I'm a fellow with the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'm a public advocate for Adnan Syed, and who is the subject of Serial. And I co-host and co-produce a podcast called Undisclosed. I recently read a book about the case called Adnan's Story. And I wrote it, and I'm deeply involved in all of this because I've known him since he was 13 years old, and Adnan is my younger brother's best friend. I've always been there as a personal family friend and like a big sister figure to him.
I was going to just start out really asking you about how you got into the case and how you got into becoming an attorney and sort of your background and how that journey went. I would like to ask you a few questions about your childhood and going to college, because a few things in your book kind of stuck out to me as a little comical and a little I could relate to. So,
sure.
Okay. And I personally liked a lot of things in the book that were more about you, and I liked learning about you. And so it was cool.
Yeah, you know, I realize, and I've talked about this, because the title of the book is not my title. The publisher picked it, and I'm like, this is not really completely, but, you know, only Adnan can write Adnan's story, and one day he'll do that, hopefully.
Well, you did a wonderful job putting the reader into Adnan's head. When did you start writing this book? What prompted the inspiration for this?
Well, you know, as Serial was ongoing, I was blogging very, you know, ferociously about the podcast, and so I was blogging a lot, writing a lot about this, tweeting about it. And there was a literary agent, I guess, who was kind of following me, and she reached out and said, listen, have you thought about writing a book about the case? And I really hadn't. And I also was kind of very resistant to the idea. I already felt very overwhelmed. You know, to me, it was just the kind of thing where Adnan will author his story when it gets out. But she convinced me that she said, listen, you know, if you don't write the book, like somebody's going to write the book. There's a lot of crime writers out there. Somebody will write the book about the case, given the popularity of this podcast and the case. So you should think about it because you know the lawyers, you know Adnan, you know the community, you know how the whole serial thing unfolded. And also, you know, do you want a complete stranger to come in and try to get it right? So that was kind of convincing, and I said, okay, I'll talk to Adnan about it, and I did. And he said, listen, if you're up for it, then you totally have my permission to do it, which was important to me. And that's why I also wanted his contribution to the book. That happened, I think I wrote a proposal for the book around the time Serial ended, which was like end of, I think, December 2014 or 2015. I'm confused now. But around the time Serial ended, I wrote a proposal for the book. Within about a month, I think we had a contract, and then I started actually writing it in earnest last June, about a year ago.
Something that stuck out to me in the book is when you talk about your childhood and growing up and your family. You do refer to growing up in a Muslim family and the differences about that. But when I was reading it, I literally just heard the same stories from all my friends that have very strict parents who don't allow them to do anything. It had nothing to do with culture or religion. It was just parenting and not allowing them to do anything, not allowing them to date, not allowing them to go to parties, stuff like that.
I think that's what parenting is about. It's like, how many ways can we restrict our kids? And that was the crazy thing about the argument that the state made, is that because Adnan lied to his parents. And I'm like, every teenager lies to their parents. And if they're not lying to their parents, something's probably wrong. They just lie about different things, you know. So we have different standards in our homes. But all kids, like, you know, test boundaries and hide stuff from parents and do things they're not supposed to be. Their parents don't want them to do. And that's just parenting, like you said.
When you were going to college, your mother said, you can talk to me. You know, you can tell me if you meet a boy.
It was a trap,
you know, it's like, and then you tell them and then it's not okay. And I mean, how old were you at that point when she got mad at you about actually talking to a boy? You were probably.
And it was more than talking to a boy. I mean, like I had, and that's the thing, because like we go into these situations with like very little experience and all these Bollywood movies in our head, you feel like you meet somebody a week later, you're in love and you're ready to get married. And that's really what happened. I met this guy like 2 times. He proposed. He was just like, it wasn't even a proposal. He's like, I would like to marry you. I want to meet your family. This is very much the Pakistani way. And I was 19. It was really my first year. It was halfway through my first year of college. And I went running home on the weekend. I was like, you know, this guy is going to come talk to you. He wants to marry me. I barely knew him. in retrospect, my mom was absolutely right. My parents were absolutely right to say, you're crazy. This is not going to happen like this. They did make me wait a few years and we did eventually get married.
Oh, I agree with that. I think everyone should wait before getting married. I think saturation time where you get to know the person. And
my own daughter's 19 and she's going to college last year. And I actually had like the talk with her a couple of weeks ago because, you know, to me, she's like my little baby. But all my, you know, my family, they're like, hey, have you started thinking about like, you know, her like meeting somebody? Are you going to introduce, like, how are you going to handle this? Because the whole Muslim dating thing is very awkward and weird right now. So I finally had a talk with her. I said, I had close to the same talk as my mother, but I actually meant it. I said, if you meet somebody nice, it's fine. You know, just if you meet a nice guy, let me know. Let us know. We're your family. You know, you don't have to hide it. And I actually expect you to go out and meet people. And my actually talk to her was like not, it was like, you know, meet multiple people, like give yourself some time and, you know, explore life and get to know people. And so hopefully she takes my advice.
I just recognized during the trial was that his attorney, Adnan's attorney, Gutierrez, how do you say her name?
Gutierrez, I guess.
She kept emphasizing his religion, emphasizing his culture, and it was totally working against him. And I almost feel like she should have downplayed it.
She, you know, she made the big mistake of not conferring with the community on how to handle this. But also, she was really losing it. I mean, she really... I don't think was completely, like, I don't think she had it together at that point. I mean, I think cognitively she was on her way down. I think she was not thinking strategically. I cannot imagine, unless I'm totally off base, that in her heyday, when she was an excellent defense attorney, that she would have done that. I think if she was completely competent at the time, she would say, all of this is irrelevant. We're talking about what happened on January 13th, 99. This has nothing to do with his background at all.
Exactly.
And that would have made sense, yeah.
It's pretty apparent to me that she was losing it, because when you hear her line of questioning, when you hear her speaking to Jay or other people, and she starts repeating herself, and she gets locked into some kind of weird point she's trying to make, and she doesn't even realize she's already made it, or what she's saying isn't going to make that point ever. Hearing her be combative with the judge and stuff, it's like, no real lawyer will do this.
I remember sitting there one time just looking, and it was, I think, one of those moments where she kept repeating things, and it was like a really, and I just looked around at other people because I was like, is anybody else seeing what I'm seeing? Is anybody else as alarmed as me? Because I couldn't believe what I was witnessing.
So was it Adnan in his whole situation that prompted you to get into law?
No, I was already in law school when he was arrested.
Okay.
I got into law because I'm a failed medical student, pre-med. And like a lot of South Asians kids, our parents want us to become doctors, and I was pre-med for 3 years. And at the end of 3 years, I'm like, this is not happening. I don't get, you know, chemistry is not my, it's not my thing, and I'm going to hate this. And I ended up getting married, actually, while I was in college. And as the time to graduate was approaching, it was a friend of mine was like, you know what, I think I'm going to sit for the LSAT. And I had never even considered it. And I thought, you know what, I'll sit for it and see how I do. I did very, very well. And I was recruited by a number of law schools, basically directly. They're like, you don't have to apply. You're just in if you want to be in.
Wow.
So I ended up in law school.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
That's awesome. I have a brother-in-law that is a doctor, and he, let's just say this, I am older than him, but he looks older than me because of what he had to go through to become a doctor. So.
Yeah. It wasn't right for me. It wasn't right for me.
Did you think that this was your calling, or was it just, hey, I'm good at this and I'm gonna roll with it? Or
no, because I had never ever in my life considered law. I really hadn't. I actually wanted, if somebody had asked me when I began college, like, what do you want to do? I wanted to be a journalist. I was very, like, I have been a big reader my whole life. I've written a lot, even in school, and I was like the editor of a school paper. Reading and writing were my thing. And but when I got to law school, I realized this is actually a very good fit. It's a lot of reading. It's a lot of writing. It's a lot of kind of logic puzzles. It's a lot of, it really pushes you kind of intellectually to, you know, figure things out. And I enjoyed it. You know, law school was not easy because I was married. I had a kid. I was living with all these in-laws, and it was really a matter of survival to get through it all. Mm-hmm. I was working. But yeah, law school to me, it wasn't that I felt like it was a calling, but once I was in it, I was like, this makes sense for, like, you know, where I'm naturally strong.
You mention it a lot in the book, and I do follow you on Twitter and other social media, and you do make a lot of reference to growing up in America as a Muslim. And what do you see as the differences, you know, between the 1990s to, say, now?
I mean, it's a huge difference. And I do try to distinguish this. Like, my family's from Pakistan. In Pakistan, the majority population is Sunni Muslim. So guess what? People like Christians and Hindus and others, they are discriminated against. This happens in every society. So there was always discrimination against minorities, including Muslims, in the 1990s. But the 9/11 and the, you know, our global war on terror, which will just, like, it seems like not end, and it's just getting worse and worse, has really exacerbated that sentiment. It has, like, almost forced this clashing of worlds. Like, people who don't care about Muslims, you know, don't really want to deal with them, and it's fine, but feel forced to confront this, right? Like, if you live in the heartland of America and are worrying about ISIS, it's kind of totally an existential threat. The ISIS is overseas killing other Muslims, but because of, like, this just entire framework of the global war on terror, you know, how it's been politicized, there is just so much more fear, suspicion, and dislike of Muslims now in America than there was when I was growing up.
Do you think that'll work against Adnan if he goes to retrial?
No, I don't think so at all, because the other side of that coin is that in the 1990s, Muslims experienced kind of everyday little bigotries and discriminations, but we weren't really, it wasn't like an issue that we took on. We also weren't organized. Like, we didn't have any advocacy organizations. Now we do. So, you know, if this came up in a trial today, and, you know, the state knows it. That's why in the last couple of years, the state, including Urich, has been like, no, it wasn't about his religion. It was just a run-of-the-mill murder case, because they know they can't pull it now. If they pull it today, we are very well organized. We have grown up as a community. We have lawyers with, you know, a decade of experience under their belt who are not going to stand for it. We also have the world watching. So there's no way they could get away with it today. What they did then, they couldn't.
I mean, he originally said this was a honor killing. And I would like you to define what a real honor killing is if one were to do that, because they totally get it wrong.
Yeah. I mean, honor killings do exist. And they exist not just in Muslim cultures. They exist across a number of cultures. And even in the book, I pointed out, even in, like, the Korean culture, this has happened. And it's a reprehensible practice that basically happens when a girl or a woman in the family has dishonored the family. Somebody in the family feels like she's brought dishonor upon their own family. So a brother, a father, a cousin, an uncle, some male member of that family will kill a girl in their own family. That is an honor killing. When a man kills, like, a partner, that's, you know, that's domestic violence, and that's, like, a different type of violence than a family killing their own daughter, sister, mother, whatever.
Exactly. And I wanted that to be defined and clear to people, that the whole premise and motive against him was based on a misunderstanding or ignorance of what it even means. So.
Yeah, it was very convenient, though. I mean, it's not that hard to figure out what honor killings mean. You know, you just call experts who work on it and look it up. But it works when you're working with a jury who has no idea. The jury has no reason to be experts on these issues. They didn't present any experts on these issues in the case, neither the defense or the prosecution. So you can, like, throw all kinds of words around and scare people.
Something that always stuck out to me about this case is Jay Wilds. Whenever I think of a crime, a murder, or some sort of event, and the law enforcement reaches out and says, hey, here's the TIPS hotline, give us a call and tell us what you know, they get a lot of people that are crazy and call in just random things.
Sure.
And they have to vet them, and they have to figure out who's telling the truth and who's not. Now, at what point in Jay's ever-changing statement should they have abandon his statement? I mean, I don't understand why some prosecutors would probably say this guy's unreliable while others will take it and just run with it.
Yeah, it's hard for me to figure out between the police and the prosecution, like how, well, first of all, we have to understand, like, the context of this case was that it was a very high profile case. There was a lot of pressure to not just make an arrest, but to get conviction in the case. The Korean community is very organized, and they have every reason, and it's, you know, completely legitimate of them to say, listen, we need you to, you know, do right by us. So there was a lot of pressure on them. As far as the police are concerned, they knew that the entire narrative is crafted. They're the ones who helped Jay come up with a story that fit the cell phone records. Simple as that. Now, I don't know if the prosecutor necessarily knew that. It could be by the time the police conveyed these things to the prosecutor, they had nailed down Jay to the point where they're like, okay, it's good enough for us. I'll be honest. I think that I don't know if the prosecution actually knew that Jay's involvement was thanks to the coaching of the police. The police definitely, I think, were engaged in some serious misconduct. They knew exactly what they were doing, and I think they didn't care. I think they thought Adnan did it, and they just needed to find a way to get him, and Jay was going to be that way. I don't think for a second the police thought Jay was really involved, because you know, they never searched his house. They never went looking for the dumpsters for a couple of months. I mean, who does that? Yeah. Right. Like, so they knew it was bullshit. They knew Jay was bullshit. They knew Jen was bullshit. But the prosecution might not have known it. What the prosecution did that was dirty was that they fought Gutierrez the entire way, in terms of, like, they wouldn't give her the statements. She was flying blind. They told the medical examiner, don't give her the medical evidence. I mean, like, so they played dirty in a different way. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they, you know, they withheld the fax cover sheet from a cell phone expert. They gave it to Gutierrez, but they gave it to her with a different set of records, so she might not have realized that it also applied to the exhibit that was at trial.
Well, here's a line that I highlighted in your book. It wasn't until the first day of trial, when evidence and preliminary motions place, that the state finally turned over Jay's police statements from February 28th and March 15th. They didn't even know until the first day of trial.
They had no idea. So you're asking an attorney and a client to create an alibi for what? For, like, they have no idea. They don't know what Jay said. They don't know if Jay is making the allegation that Adnan kept her in a, you know, in a basement for 3 days and killed. Like, they have no idea what the state's theory of the case is. And it's nearly impossible to create a defense in that case. But I will say this. So I do say that, yeah, definitely Gutierrez was at a huge disadvantage, but she had every advantage going into the second trial.
She did, and she still botched it for who knows why. I guess health effects, because reasonable explanation.
Yeah. The minute she realized that this, you know, Jay testified and all of this was concentrated about after school, she should have been like, we got to figure out where he was after school, and she should have reached out to Asia McClain. Mm-hmm.
Just because the whole timeline is based off of Jay's ever-changing statements, does a prosecutor need to get the timeline correct to prove guilt, and how much weight should it hold?
I mean, unless you're going to make the argument that the only thing the prosecutor has to say is that we think this guy did it and this is his motive, and convince a jury of that, that, you know, the actual crime, how it happened, how he got to the victim, how he got rid of all forensic evidence, like, none of that matters, then we are in big trouble as a society, because that's a very low bar for a prosecution to meet.
Exactly.
If you're going to charge somebody with murder and take away their entire life, you should be able to say, this is exactly how it was done, and this is the evidence. You can't just say, well, maybe it was this time, no, maybe it was this time, maybe it was that time. The judge's opinion, you know, Judge Welch's opinion at the end of this appeal process says exactly that. And when he keeps saying, I was perplexed, I mean, he's saying this is bullshit. He's like, your timeline's bullshit. There's no way any of that come get me call happened. There's no call that made sense. So that's why the judge said, you know, in this appeal, Asia is credible. Gutierrez should have called her. But because that timeline was so, like, the judge actually thought that the jury realized that that timeline was crazy anyways, and it was irrelevant. So he thought that the jury convicted Adnan because of the Linkin Park pings, because that was the real evidence. That was, like, the scientific documentation, right?
And the whole thing that gave Jay any sort of, you know, credibility was everyone points to he knew where Hayes' car was dumped. But at the same time, I don't know, how do you respond to that one sticking point that most people have about Jay's statement?
Oh, I respond at length in the book, and I explain a sequence of events in late February of 1999 that might explain how Jay, or, you know, basically might the whole, I don't want to get into it now because I do want people to read it. And it also is a little bit complicated, but I lay out step by step what happened those days in the investigation and why there's reason to believe that the police already knew where the car was.
Perfect. With the investigation and all the pretrial melee, witness testimony, defense screw-ups, what was something that, while you were sitting there or paying attention to most of this, that you found completely unfair? What was something that really stuck out to you that you wished you could have changed, or if something you could change about his trial?
Well, nothing was more deeply unfair than his, for a 17-year-old to be accused of murder based on his religion and ethnicity. I mean, I think the idea that he's both this crazy fundamentalist Muslim, but at the same time he's smoking pot and sleeping around and drinking. you know, it's just so ridiculous. But I do think, I actually disagree with Judge Welch that Asia McClain would have changed the outcome of the trial. Because here's the thing, at the end of the day, if, I mean, just imagine the closing argument. You know, the prosecutor said in the closing argument, by 2:36 p.m., Heyman Lee was dead. If Gutierrez was able to get up on closing and say, until 2:40 p.m., Adnan was with this girl, Asia McClain, at the Woodlawn Library, and her boyfriend saw him, and his friend saw him. Because Asia was potentially a gateway to two other witnesses who also had picked her up, and maybe 99 would have remembered that if she had contacted them in a timely way. That would have been the end, you know, because the jury can't, honestly, they won't process, they won't give a crap about the Lincoln Park pings if you have three people saying, we were in the library exactly when the state's saying, with him, when the state's saying she was killed by.
Yeah, all of a sudden that 2:32 call and the 7:06 calls, they mean nothing if you don't
right.
have them. Yeah.
I think the jury would be like, okay, we don't know what Jay's deal is, but maybe he was involved, but this is bullshit because this guy, the state's saying that she's murdered at this time, and this guy's like at the library and we have witnesses. And Asia's a very credible witness. And maybe by at that point, they might have been able to find some video evidence. I don't know. Maybe not. But anyhow, the point is, I think Asia would have made all the difference in the trial.
Something else you wrote in the book was... You were talking about how you saw West Memphis 3 documentary and how there was the whole satanic panic going on and people that were afraid of the occult. I'm assuming you were kind of connecting people's fears of the occult and people's fears of Islam at the time.
Sure. Yeah, I'm pretty sure public opinion polling will show you that Muslims rank below Satanists. Yeah, we pretty much won that opinion poll. But it's just about the human condition, right? Like we always, and as a society and every, not just America, it's everywhere. Like we kind of like to have these common enemies, right? Whether it's communism or the Red Scare or the Japanese or there's always some boogeyman, and the boogeyman will change sometimes. And the boogeyman right now is Muslims and Islam. And I hope that eventually goes away. But the truth is when it does, it'll probably be some other group. And that's kind of the sad thing about it. So, but definitely, you know, I think in the West Memphis 3 case, that absolutely, it was all about that. It was like, these guys are basically a bunch of emo kids who are like, you know, into occult, and that translates into XYZ.
Yeah. So what is your reaction when in Adnan's case, they granted his retrial more or less based on the cell phone tower pings and the defense not cross-examining properly for that, as opposed to Asia?
It was a surprise, but when I saw the order first, which was like, which is just the denied, granted. And I was surprised to read the order. I mean, although in the end of the day, we just needed to win on one issue. I didn't kind of matter what issue that was. But when I read the opinion, I thought it was brilliant. I'm like, basically the judge, because the judge is making factual findings, which are very hard to challenge, by the way, on the appellate level. But the judge is saying your entire timeline is bullshit. There was no come and get me call. Like, none of that matters. So he's left the door open for Asia by saying she's credible, but he's kind of sealed the casket on the timeline thing for the state. I think the ruling is absolutely right. I mean, it was egregious not to have this evidence, you know, this facts cover sheet when it's directly relevant to the state's case to say that these incoming calls show where he was. And AT&T is like, nope, they don't. I mean, how much more direct can it be? So... I was very happy with the ruling. I think it's a really strong ruling, and I think there's no way the state can win this.
Do you expect them to actually take it to retrial, or do you think they're going to offer him a plea or something?
You know what? If we weren't dealing with some really cocky people at the Attorney General's office, I might think reasonable people would say this is stupid. We're not going to spend taxpayer dollars on a case that's so flimsy and just give him a plea. But there, I mean, I don't know. This particular prosecutor, Vigna Raja, I don't know. I feel like he might be cocky enough to be like, I'm going to try this thing. And you know what? We are so prepared for that. We have an amazing pro bono legal team that's come on board with Justin Brown that we would welcome the opportunity to destroy them in court.
Well, I mean, at this point, it's gone through several times. And I feel that I just assume that when you're analyzing Jay's statements, you have this huge flow chart on your wall of each, you know, change and in discrepancy in it, and you can hand that over to the attorneys to take into court and have him read off police statements. This day you said this day you said that, you know. I can only imagine how hard it was to even find all the discrepancies in his statements.
Oh, not only that, we have documentation of, you know, him, his entire story of how, you know, the police went to Jen and they went to, no, they didn't at all. We have proof that they didn't. But they started with Jay, you know, they began harassing him. And then we have this intercept interview that we can use to impeach him. The autopsy report basically shows that everything about the state's case, about how she was killed and when she was buried, is wrong. And we have subpoena power. And so now with a team like this, God, we would subpoena the heck out of everybody. We would. And you know, a defendant is allowed to show alternatives, you know, to show alternative suspects in court. There's a lot we would want to probably present about Sellers and Don.
I always lean towards Sellers, or Mr. S, as they call him. I never really thought much of Don myself, but what's your take on both of them?
I personally don't believe for a second that Mr. S stumbled across the body the way he said he did. And, you know, we have another team of investigators that are looking very closely at what happened that day that he says he found the body. And, you know, there's stuff that I can't talk about right now, but There is something very shady there. I don't think that necessarily means that he was involved, but I do think he might have ended up there looking at her, you know, looking for her body. I don't know. I don't believe the way, you know, the story about how he found the body. As far as Don is concerned, I mean, it's clear that, you know, he needs... that if I were to reopen the investigation, I would start with Don, because his alibi just doesn't hold up. He doesn't have an alibi, which, again, doesn't necessarily mean he's guilty. You don't have to have an alibi. I think what's concerning about Don is that that an alibi was, it seems, falsified at a time when nobody really knew anything had happened to her. And that's definitely a matter of concern to me. Again, I don't think it means that innocent people do really guilty-looking stuff all the time. Yeah. They do. They're scared. But I don't think it hurts to start there. And I also hope that, you know, and if there's a new trial, we are definitely going to hunt down the forensics, you know, the hairs that didn't match Jay or Adnan. Well, how come nobody else was taking hair samples from? Not Don, not anybody in Hayes' family. So you've got fingerprints in the car that weren't identified. Well, guess what? Don wasn't fingerprinted. Alonzo Sellers wasn't fingerprinted. There's a world of investigation that needed to be done that wasn't.
It's something I actually didn't know, was that her body was found more or less in a depression in the ground, which would go totally against the burying her. I didn't understand that before.
Shovels. That's why the police never actually went to look for the shovels. There were no shovels. There was no digging. That's why Jay's like, he kept getting confused. Oh, we dug for 20 minutes. Oh, we dug for an hour. I mean, Jay, I was shown the pictures of, you know, the crime, the burial site, basically. And I think he was just trying to, like, to the best of his ability, to come up with a story that would match what that scene looked like. So while it might have looked like, you know, she was below ground surface, it's actually a natural depression there. It's like under this hollow. So somebody just kind of left her there and covered her up with loose dirt. There wasn't a burial.
I'm just very evidence-based myself, and it, to the point of sometimes being a detriment to the, where I'm not even sympathetic. With her body, what's the term? It's lividity, where the blood pools up. It's shown that she was laying flat on her front, for many hours. But yet when they found her body, she was on her side.
Yeah, she was kind of twisted on her side, yeah.
And according to Jay's statement, she was in a trunk or in a car. I mean,
pretzeled up.
so how is, I guess to me, it's how is that supposed to happen? She was laying down. She wasn't balled up in a car or in a trunk. So
it didn't happen. I mean, that's the short answer, is that it didn't happen. I think, wherever Hay was killed, you know, it had to be a place where her body could have been left face down for around 10 hours before it was moved, you know, and undisturbed. So maybe a private area. I don't know. There are people who theorize, well, maybe Adnan killed her, dumped her in Lincoln Park face down, then went back to move her. And my thing is, I mean, there's two responses. Number one, you can theorize everything you want, but guess what? There's not a single witness who said that. If you're going to hang your hat on Jay, why would Jay not just say that, right? Like, that's not – or the second thing is, why would anybody go back to a, you know, murder victim and say, now I'm going to expose myself by moving her again? Like, it isn't – the other thing is this. If Hay was actually – had been killed, left in Lincoln Park face down while lividity set in, we would see evidence of that even in the lividity. Because when lividity sets in, and you can actually, since you're science, you know, oriented, you can look up some of these photographs online. When people die, even on mattresses that have a lot of quilting and the lividity sets in, you can see the quilt marks. You can see the marks of like a person's underwear on that body, because that the way the blood pools, it leaves these impressions on almost everything. So one of the most interesting things to me is the fact that there aren't a lot of marks in her body that would show that she was like lying on a pile of leaves, or it's almost like she was on a very smooth surface.
Yeah, like a, I would assume like a basement floor of some type.
maybe carpeted, a carpeted floor, maybe a bed, you know, or a blanket. I don't know, something that didn't leave a lot of marks.
Not a trunk of a car. That's just...
Unless you're going to tell me that a girl who's 5'8 can be laid out flat in the trunk of a car. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, and that's, I guess that's my whole problem, is between the prosecutor's timeline and they say, well, here's this phone call and here's where she was found, here's this tower ping and this guy's statements, link it up. But when you look at the evidence of the body, it blows the entire timeline out.
I feel like, you know, the most concrete evidence we have of what happened to Hay that day is really her body, is to look at that autopsy report. And that was something that Gutierrez really also missed. And, you know, Serial also didn't look at it at all. So it is important to start there.
Especially someone like me, who I'm just like, what does the evidence tell us? What was the DNA? What was the fingerprint? What is the microfiber found? Whatever. I go, well, no, I can't accept it. Because if I have to accept the prosecution's timeline, now all the evidence needs to fit that. And it doesn't. again, you know, I wasn't there. Nobody knows what happened that day, but we have to reconstruct it the best we can. And I feel it was totally missed.
And I wonder, by the way, as this was, you know, started to being discussed online about the lividity issue, and I think Susan might have blogged about it, like when Jay's Intercept interview came out and all of a sudden he changed the burial time to midnight, I was like, oh, that's really conveniently interesting, because that is probably closer to the time she was actually buried. And I can't help but wonder, honestly, and that's the kind of subpoena power I hope we have, is to know whether he's still in touch with state actors who are telling him, now you have to change your story to this. I don't know. I don't put it beyond the pale. I really don't. Baltimore's shady. I mean, I don't know if you've read that DOJ report. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, and I don't want to go on a total Jay bashing fest, but when he made his public statement, what was it, like 2-3 years ago, again, he changed his story. He talked about the trunk pop again, and I was like, well, wait a second, but you've at least sync it up with one of your prior statements, and then I can at least say, oh, well, at least he was somewhat consistent, but even...
I mean, you know, not just the trunk pop. To me, what was, I think, some of the most, first of all, the burial time, such a big difference in the burial time. Like you're saying, suddenly it's like in the middle of the night instead of 7 p.m. And there's, you can make the argument to me, I didn't want to tell people that the trunk pop happened to my grandma's as I'm protecting grandma. Explain to me, how does your grandma figure into 7 p.m. versus midnight? There's no advantage to grandma if you change your, you know, trying to protect her by making 7 p.m. So the other thing that I thought was really... just kind of mind-blowing with an interview was Jay now saying, well, two things, saying that he never was at the burial, like he didn't see her body be buried. He never actually, like all he did was drive cars around, I guess, for Adnan, but he was never at the burial site, where in his previous statements, he's given all these details of she was twisted like this and we dug for this many minutes. And him saying that, I don't know that she was killed at Best Buy. I was told that. Like, who told you that?
That's where the trunk pop happened, was at the Best Buy parking lot. Like, it's just...
Or one of the versions. Yeah,
one of the versions. So I guess, to me, it's when do you say this guy no longer is credible? that's always been my problem there.
That's a question for the state.
Yeah. As far as some of his appeals, they really disregarded Asia. They disregarded some of Adnan's statements on his saying that he didn't leave the school. He didn't do, you know, but he did because he went to the library. Just, it's really intriguing to me that they will use it against the defense or the accused, but the people attacking the prosecutors, they can get away with saying whatever they want, whereas the accused has to literally say the exact right thing at all times. Otherwise, it is used against them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, any discrepancy from the defendant or defense witness is pounced on, like, this is... And this is what happened to Asia in the PCR hearing in February. The prosecutor was, like, really, really... I mean, I don't know if you've read her book, and I wasn't... Yeah, I was sequestered, but I was following everything, and Susan is amazing. Susan Simpson was sitting throughout it, and she literally wrote, like, I think, almost 200 pages of notes, like, almost transcribing what was happening. So... you know, but the prosecutor did that over and over again with Asia, you know, like trying to attack every little discrepancy. This is like, again, a teenager who wrote a letter to Adnan trying to just, you know, be helpful and say, I remember this. So, yeah, this is a problem. But when it comes to witness, you're like, oh, well, you take your witnesses as you find them. That's somebody who's going to, I mean, you know, when you're talking about somebody's life, putting them away for life or even the death penalty in some cases, your standards have to be a little bit higher for your witnesses, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about a lot of cases that I cover is I don't even know if this guy's innocent or guilty, but at the end of the day, I want the system to do the right thing, and I want them to truly prove that they are guilty and not be it based on some sort of his alibi is not admissible or, oh, his background is admissible. Like, how is that possible? How is an alibi not admissible, right, but his religion is? And I've seen so many cases where a man cheats on his wife and they dig up this email that he sent to his mistress from 2 years before the murder. And they're like, see, look, he had motive. And it's like, right, how is that admissible? But then him being at work the day that she was murdered is not admissible. Like,
Yeah. There are some crazy cases. I mean, I was in Philadelphia last week and met with people from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and they even showcased some cases in which it's unbelievable where you have like evidence of this defendant literally being at a different place, like video evidence of him being in another place at the time that the murder occurred. And they, you know, for some reason, it wasn't presented at trial, defendant's convicted, and now they cannot bring it up at appeal. They're like precluded. It's tragic, and that's the problem with the system, that we are designed to get convictions and not necessarily get justice.
When a prosecutor does not bring charges against somebody, whether it be a police officer or maybe a politician or something to that effect, I mean, sometimes it's very upsetting because you're like, hey, that guy absolutely did something bad. But do you ever feel like, well, that's actually the way the system's supposed to work? Before bring charges, they're supposed to vet everything and understand where this person stands.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think, I work in a policy field called CVE, which is countering violent extremism. And a lot of that also requires kind of looking at terrorism cases that are brought in the country. And, you know, there are legal, you have laws, and the laws determine, they should determine, like, you know, the kind of charges that can be brought. But I'm not going to pretend that there isn't a selective bias against the kind of charges that are brought. It is true that poor black people get every charge in the world thrown at them, you know, whereas if you are maybe a little more privileged, maybe have the means to really properly defend yourself, a prosecutor might not try that. There are amazing, wonderful prosecutors out there who really do the right thing. And there are others who are trying to get a win. So what they do is they pile up all the charges they could conceive of and hope that it's enough to get the defendant to just plead guilty and fold and not really fight it because they don't have the wherewithal to do it. I do recognize sometimes if a police officer is not charged, like they don't have the requisite elements, you know, to meet the statutory requirements of that charge. Those things have to be looked at. It's true for terrorism cases. It's true for, you know, because I know sometimes people say, well, that person did X, Y, and Z, and how come he wasn't charged with terrorism? Well, there's elements you have to meet, you know, to be charged with certain crimes.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Another question, just to kind of get your take on something that I was thinking about, is in Adnan's case, we've shown that the cell phone tower pings do not add up to much, especially if you take the timeline and everything, but the data that they were getting from them does not specifically set their location. In the Stephen Avery case, Kathleen Zellner is saying that she's going to put Teresa Halbach somewhere else besides at the Avery property because of a cell phone tower ping. And I have a hard time resolving that. Like, I think, well, if with Adnan, if doesn't mean anything, then how can we make it mean something in another case?
Yeah, you know, that is, and I honestly, that's a question for Susan Simpson, who is like the expert on this stuff. The case that we're looking at right now, undisclosed, Joey Watkins, the cell phone evidence and the pings are also going to come into play. One thing I think it's fair to say is, even though cell phone pings generally, I would say in a very reliable way, cannot tell you where you are, they can generally tell you where you're not. So if my tower right now, if I'm talking on the phone and I'm pinging in San Francisco, you can probably safely say that I'm definitely not in Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah.
But to place somebody exactly where they are, you know, as far as I know, unless it's because of a different network or because the experts from that particular network can say with a certain amount of reliability that no, our network functions differently. You can definitely. But the other thing is this, and I don't know Teresa Halbach's phone, but I'm assuming it was also kind of like one of the old phones. It's not like a GPS. See, now we have GPS and stuff on our phones, so you can tell exactly where a person is.
Yeah.
Whereas before, the technology wasn't that. It was like the ping. But with a tower ping, I think the closest thing to a reliable assessment we can make is that if a phone pings in a tower, it's most likely the phone is in the region the tower covers, and that region can be really vast. But that region is also completely unreliable because of, you know, they say if there's like an kind of interference for one reason, it can be bounced to another tower, or a tower is overloaded, it can be bounced to another tower. So I don't know. I look forward to seeing what the argument she's going to make in this case is. But if she could show, for example, that Halbach's phone pinged a tower that was just completely way out of the region, then it might be safe to make the argument that while we don't know exactly where she was, she definitely was not in this region. But I don't, honestly, I'm not completely clear. And it seems, and even I've had this conversation with Susan, she's like, listen, the networks are different. So it depends on the networks. It depends on, like, you know, like when in time we're talking about technology, 99 versus 2005 versus 2016. There's just so many factors here.
The other question I had is, in the book, you were talking about how Adnan was not asking for help from anybody. And you go and you find Sarah and you drum up this attention for him. Now, he did eventually give his blessing for this, but did you feel like you were kind of going behind his back? Do you feel like you were betraying him when you first started going to the media?
No, I didn't. I didn't feel like I was betraying him. I felt like I was. I felt like I was just doing the thing that he was scared to do, or anybody. You know, I just felt like it was the right thing to do, and I figured that if we found the right journalist, obviously at the end of the day, if I found a journalist and Adnan said, no, I'm not doing it, that would be the end of it, you know. But in the end, the choice would have been his, right? So I knew that. Him and his family could obviously always trump a decision like this. But I already knew we were going to lose this PCR, and I knew we had nowhere else to go. So I saw nothing to lose.
Did you ever think that Serial would become number one in all of the podcasting world?
No, I didn't know she was going to do a podcast. I didn't know what a podcast was. I really thought it would be kind of a This American Life episode, like a one, you know, hour episode. And I actually didn't think it would help our case at all, to be honest. I didn't care what Sarah was going to produce. I really cared about her investigation. I was just hoping over that course of that 8-9 months that she would be able to talk to the right person, find the right thing. Maybe somebody would say something that would give us something new to go back to court with. That's what I was hoping for. I wasn't really thinking about the end product because I didn't think a 1-hour show was going to do anything for us.
Yeah. And to be honest, we attempted to cover this case on the Generation Y in an hour. You can't. It just doesn't work.
Like, if you think about it, Sarah did 12 episodes. We've done 40 on Undisclosed. Bob Ruff on Truth and Justice podcast did like 36.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said.
But because of Serial, you have Bob Ruff. You have all of this community.
Absolutely.
Even if Sarah didn't exactly do what you wanted or didn't say or follow a certain narrative, she opened a door to worlds that might
all the
not.
Doors. Yeah. She opened all the doors. I mean, like, there's no arguing that.
Yeah. I liked Serial a lot. I can't say that I was the biggest fan like other people were, but I thought it was well produced and I very much enjoyed it. But when you started Undisclosed, that's the meat of it. That's what I really wanted to hear was the in the sticks, you know, analyst of the legal system and all that. So to me, Serial was kind of more popular to get the you know, the masses to listen,
but
then to get the details is...
And that has its own value. I mean, like, if we had just done Undisclosed, nobody would be paying attention, you know? The BBC wouldn't be reporting on the case. I mean, so Serial was absolutely necessary for everything else to happen. And it brought, like you said, it opened the doors to the people like Susan Simpson, Bob, Colin, and so many others behind the scenes who have really contributed to the case in a very tangible way.
I will say, though, I thought I knew a lot about this case. I thought I had all the details down until I read your book. And it really opened my eyes to a lot more things, and it really does dig into a lot of details that I might have just kind of had a cursory observation of, or just, you know. So even with your Undisclosed podcast, there was things in your book that I didn't hear in your podcast. So I was like, wow, I didn't know that. Like, I didn't know Adnan had actually met a female while he was in prison.
You know, I mean, look, so Undisclosed is not about the human interest story. It's really about the legal investigative stuff going on. We don't, that's why you've never, Adnan's never been on this show, although we had thought about interviewing him, but I think it's better that we didn't. Even, you know, we were precluded from it, but I think it turned out better because we are not focusing on like a human interest thing like Serial did. We just went right to the meat and potatoes of the actual case. But the book obviously had to bring in like the personal stories connected to all this. And I really wanted to give Adnan a chance to write his own words and tell the stories that nobody else was able to so far.
Yeah, I really felt like I was in his head reading your book. And I sometimes forgot that I was reading your words. I thought I was reading his. And I realize you have a lot of his letters and excerpts in there, but you really are close to him and you were able to portray that. And I really enjoyed that. I was really floored by the book, to tell you the truth. So
far the response has been really good. A lot of you know, reviews are good. And for me, I was very concerned about like literary reviews. I'm like, God, I don't want to like write a book and people are like, this is a terribly written book. So, you know, I feel very thankful that that people are enjoying the book.
I won't ask about negative things, but you know, people always say, well, Undisclosed, you know, Rabia, she's just on his bandwagon. Do you think that detracts from what you've written or what you've done for him so far?
I don't understand. Like, that's what an advocate does.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's my, that as somebody who is a family friend, a big sister, like, what do people expect from me? I mean, and I actually find, I'm very offended when people say to me, yeah, well, we think he's, you know, this and that. We think he's a psychopath. Because I feel like saying, would you say that to his mother? Like, you don't understand, like, my relationship with Adnan is like, I'm fiercely defensive of him because like, he's like a little brother to me. And I would not have spent 15, 17 years of tears and prayers for somebody who I didn't believe was completely innocent of this. And I've heard people say things like, I've seen things online. I've heard people say, well, you know, she probably just wants to get him out, but she knows that he might have been involved. I'm like, that's the most ridiculous. Like, how unprincipled would that be? I mean, and these are people obviously don't know me and don't know him. So, you know, for people who cannot take a story from somebody who is like close to a story, well, that precludes you from a lot of stories then. And I don't know what to say to that. I just don't know what to say to that. I mean, don't read it. Don't follow it. Move on with your life.
That was the sad part, is people were accusing Sarah of that with Serial. I'm like, I actually thought Serial was pretty unbiased. I thought she did a pretty good job as far as trying to stay neutral in there.
Yeah, she did. But, you know, even the idea that she should be neutral, I mean, like, I don't understand, like, at what point did journalism devolve into what we are just reporting the facts? I mean, investigative journalism takes a stand. Mm-hmm. It takes a stand, but it bases it on evidence, right?
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong with a person taking a stand as long as you have the evidence to back it up. So I thought that was a very unfair thing to say to Sarah. I thought the whole thing is complicated for her. I mean, you read about how complicated it was for Adnan and for all of us. But for her to be like almost like a robot and not have any kind of human reaction to any of this is a crazy expectation.
Yeah. And for anyone that has yet to buy your book, that chapter of how Sarah and him are interacting and all the things going through his head and what he should share and how he should talk to her, it's very intriguing because I never thought of that. And I might have done the same thing he did, was I don't want her to like me for me. I want her to get to the truth. And I'm not going to share myself with her because I want her to base it off facts and not off my personality.
I mean, it's the most terrible dilemma because ever since the judge said to him at 18 that you being a nice person is you being manipulative. Can you imagine? They're like, oh my God, if I'm nice, people think I'm manipulative. Like, how do you live your life? Like, what do you do then? Not be a nice person? Like, what? Yeah. It's terrible what that psychologically did to him.
Exactly. You can't be totally unbiased. You have to take a stand. And I know that even Aaron and I on Generation Y, we've gone back and taken down some old episodes and redid them because we didn't take a stance. We just said, here's the evidence, you decide. And they were really flat. No one cared. I won't keep you too long. I know you're busy and you're at the hotel, and I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much, Justin. I appreciate it.
All right.
Have a good
day. Have a good one.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments. But business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.